Thank you. So I'm happy to be back. It's always nice. Nice workshop. Thank you for the organization. What I want to talk about today is, the title was flavor at the LHC. And this is work that appeared as the first paper of many that appeared. It came out in 07-12 with Eric Poppitz, who was at the workshop earlier in the quarter, as well as Neil Weiner.
First of many.
So we all know that supersymmetry is one of those possibilities that we might find at the LHC. And there are many different studies of different points in this, in the vast parameter space that it has. But in the low energy effective theory of it, the so-called MSSM, we all know that there are potential problems with this, namely so-called flavor problems. And basically what I want to talk about today for the duration is a different approach to how you consider flavor in supersymmetry. Now, to sort of go into this, it's probably best to back up a couple of steps, especially at the request of the organizers, although it's hardly necessary for this audience now I think about it. But just to remind ourselves what we're talking about with flavor and why supersymmetry has new contributions to it. So in the standard model, we all know that flavor results from Yukawa couplings, such as these. And I'll write this in following notation. And as well as the leptons. And the entirety of the so-called flavor structure, namely the various different generations of quarks that we have that all mix with each other, the entirety of the flavor structure of the model is buried within these 3x3 Yukawa matrices. Now, of course, this is not the end of the story, because we have the ability to rotate away various combinations of the y's, yu's, and yd's, by doing field redefinitions of the q's and the u's. And we all know these famous field redefinitions that have the effect of turning these couplings to the Higgs into ones that are diagonal with respect to flavor. And all of those rotations that you do, the so-called left-handed rotations on the U quarks and the right-handed rotations on, so left-handed rotations on these guys, the right-handed rotations on these guys, and both for the up-type and the down-type quarks, you do these rotations and the Yukawa matrices disappear, leaving you with only one residual that you can't get rid of, which is, of course, the famous contribution to the weak current, right, which is proportional to, say, U dagger, and then whatever the matrices were that we had from that, say, LU, RU, MU. This is the only place, this is the only residual of these rotations to bring this into its diagonal form, namely this GAM matrix. So the sense then is that in the standard model, all of the flavor structure resides in the CKM matrix, which then is a different CKM matrix which enters into the weak interactions, the weak current. And so therefore, all of the flavor physics enters through weak interactions, as we all know. Great. Now we go and we think about supersymmetry. So by supersymmetry, I mean the stupidest thing you could do, right? You supersymmetrize everything, and you write down all of the terms that you can do with arbitrary couplings. As we do that, we would end up with similar Yukawa couplings to now the MSSM, except that we have an Higgs up and Higgs down here. Okay. all of these things carry over now into superfields. And so, do the field redefinitions of the superfields and, you know, the flavor structure of the Ys still ends up in the CKM matrix, just as it did before. But now, because supersymmetry is broken, we have a series of operators, series of interactions, which cause a difference between the different components of the superfields, namely the soft breaking, right? And in all of the soft breaking, and let me just start writing a few of the obvious operators, things like Q tilde, and here I mean the squarks, squared, and maybe I'll even write MQ, plus say, let's write the down type 1. Okay, so here are some of the soft mass squareds that enter as a result of breaking supersymmetry, giving masses to the quarks larger than the quarks, as they have to be for direct searches. We haven't certainly seen quarks of the same mass as the squarks is the same mass as the quarks. There are, in addition to these dimension two operators, there are also all of the A terms, as we know, so the terms that come from the analog of the Yukawa couplings, but now written in terms of the just the scalar components. So say things like Q, B, H down, with and let me rewrite this, with some dimension one, well, with some coefficient, this is a dimension three operator, so with some dimension one coefficient, but the coefficient itself having its own flavor dependence, so-called A terms, or scalar trilinear couplings. And again, there is no, okay. So the same rotations that we did over here on superfields to push the Yukawa structure of the flavor sector into the CKM matrix, doing the same rotations here, you can see that this doesn't obviously go through, unless the form of these matrices here and here is very special. So if I do a rotation under this, then I would end up with something like an L, MQ squared, dagger L. And only if this took a particular form, say like diagonal, does this go through, and that I end up with squark masses that don't have flavor structure. But if I generate these squark masses, in particular at some high scale above where flavor breaking occurred, there's no reason to expect that upon doing these rotations that I would end up into a diagonal form. And so,
not just diagonal, and
universal. Yeah, absolutely. Diagonal and universal, yeah, exactly.
Sufficient just to be diagonal.
No. So the statement
after
you do the rotations, it better be exactly. Yeah.
Same basis as the course.
Correct. So, but this is well known, right? This is the age-old problem, which all persists within supersymmetry, the so-called supersymmetric flavor problem. Which is simply to say that there are many more parameters of the model which contain flavor structure, of which can be completely independent of the structure of the Yukawas that you start with. So, so then as a reminder as to how bad the situation can be, let me remind you of the bounds that come in on this. Although actually, just before I do that, let me do one small aside. Since it will be useful for the whole talk, let me define a couple of quantities that then I will relate to and come back to as I go throughout the talk. These mass matrices here, these scalar mass squared matrices, MQ squared, and say MD squared, as well as say the A term, and if this The particular one I've written is the one corresponding to the downtype Yukawa, so let's label it AD. So these are matrices, 3 by 3. And actually, to be clear, what I'm actually going to refer to is the matrices after I do the rotations under Y. So actually, this whole blob here. Okay. So the effective matrices at low energies, the ones that would actually enter into observables, are ones that can come from the superfields that came from the left-handed quarks, superfields scalars that came from superfields from the left-handed quarks, scalars that came from superfields from the right-handed quarks, as well as A terms which connect the left and right quarks together. Yeah. So all of this MQ squared, will then have components in it, whatever they are in the diagonal, and it's often conventional then to write this in the following way. If the off-diagonal terms are, if you want to normalize this matrix in terms of some quantity, you take perhaps some average along the diagonal, and then you will write this as something that is, say, order one upon some average mass squared, and then deltas in the off-diagonal entry. Okay, so that many of the quantities that I'll be talking about end up being proportional to these entries. Why? Because they are simply the entries that tell me how much supersymmetry breaking connects one flavor to another. And it's just in a normalized basis. So in this case, these deltas, because they came from Q, an up-type quark, so they will correspond to ones that are called left-left, which is to simply say that I'm connecting one left-handed quark to another left-handed quark. If I did this for the down type, again, similar notation. This would correspond to a right-right mixing, which is again just to say I'm taking the flavor basis. This is the okay. Try to get that in sync, and we'll have a fun time. In the flavor basis, this is the connection between then the different delta, as I've defined it, is dimensionless by pulling out some average mass square.
Is it in person square?
Whoa, one person at a time, or I'm going to get confused.
Is it one over square?
Oh, yes, right. I have the
square of the
Oh.
People calling each other.
Shouldn't that be the number?
Ramen.
It's okay now.
All right. Yeah, I knew there was something wrong. Okay. Very good. And then, of course, A terms, the famous scalar trileaters, which are dimension one, so even I can get that right, say some average A, okay? Then this, they will have their own form, whatever this is. And I'm not going to, well, these two will have something that you can write as deltas. But now, perhaps the way to be actually completely clear about this is, what does an A term do? Well, by itself, just connected up as here, this is a coupling between three scalars, but after the Higgs gets an expectation value, then it leads to a mass term for the quarks, okay, connecting the two up. So it's actually V times A will have the form of a mass matrix, so some average, and then that will have then, so that this whole thing is a mass squared matrix, this thing is a mass squared matrix, which I can then write in a form analogous to this with deltas in the off diagonals, right? And these deltas again are now, not surprisingly, left-right, because I'm connecting up a left-handed quark with a right-handed quark. Okay, so this is just the notation because I'll use this as we go.
So I have a question on the VA terms. So for the quark, it's okay, usually we assume the diagonal ones are roughly the same. But for A term, the third generation, typically people assume it's much larger than the first two generations.
Yes, you're asking about whether this is, whether one assumes proportionality or not.
Yeah, because in your case, the diagonal is all one, which means the four generations have the same kind of A-terms.
Indeed. So let me state this in a slightly different way. So if A-terms were large and were not proportional to Yukawa's, this can lead to even more disasters beyond the so-called flavor problem, right? Because I can write diagrams which will then connect A-terms with Gaugino's and give me a fermion mass, right? Because this is a left-right coupling. And the fermion masses could be large, much larger than what you would get from here. Yeah. So this is the sense that A terms are assumed to be proportional so that you don't run into this problem. Now, a flavor model can predict that, in particular if you break supersymmetry. If you break flavor above where you break supersymmetry, then the superpotential couplings as well as these guys will have this proportionality, but not necessarily. This is a UV-dependent question. Yeah? So in the low-energy model, you don't know. Okay, so here's this the situation of the MSSM and various notation of left and right. Now, what does this do? Okay. So one of the most, or perhaps the most dangerous contribution is to not Cannon bar mixing. And by this, in the standard model, we had diagrams that looked like this. Okay, where now I have to remember what a K-naught is. we'll take a stab at it. I know it's this much, but now I have to remember that. Very good. Yeah, I know one is bar. It's a meson. Okay, come on.
Just always remember that strange number is strange. It's the opposite of what you would think.
Ah, fantastic. All right. So we have this, and however I want to write it, SD bar, okay, something like that. And of course, this has to, the mixing between a K0 and a K0 bar has to go through W's because it comes from CKM. So clearly, we have CKM suppression in all of these vertices, as well as since it is a W going through the loop, you have a G weak, or just G if you like, sitting in each of the vertices. Okay, so this thing is proportional to G to the fourth or alpha weak squared times combinations of CKM elements. And of course, this leading to the famous Jim suppression that you get for the size of the contribution. In supersymmetry, we can now take something similar to this diagram, and let's take something similar. So let's first draw in the fermions. No, let's not draw in. Well, let's draw in the external fermions. That much is invariant. Okay, DSR. And I'm going to not label the rest for a moment. But now I can supersymmetrize the gauge bosons as well. But if I supersymmetrize the gauge bosons, then I must have scalars running through here. And this is the famous diagram, which most of you already know. And all right, here is one of a set of the contributions that leads to K0 bar mixing in supersymmetry. But, right, and there's always the but is that it doesn't have to be the supersymmetrized W that enters the loop, but you can have a supersymmetrized gluino that enters the loop. Because this flavor mixing that entered into the soft breaking mass squared matrices, or A terms, doesn't have anything to do with the weak interactions per se, and it doesn't rotate into them. And so, in fact, the worst offender to K0 bar will go through a gluino diagram simply because now this coupling between the gluino to the quark-squark will go like G strong. So this is enhanced by a power of alpha S squared upon alpha weak squared. Now, so this mixing, how does it happen? Well, we've got a D coming in, so we've got a D squark, S squark, and there is some flavor mixing that in the flavor basis, this is what it looks like. So by this, what do we mean? We mean, well, we go over to one of our squark mass matrices, could be of the left-left type, could be of the right-right type, and we pick up a contribution that is proportional to the D and S mixing here, this delta. So this delta, which could be, as I say, a left-left, or a right-right, or a left-right, since we can also do it down here. Similarly, over here, we have another mixing between these quantities. So whatever, E, S, etc. And again, there is a delta of whatever the form it takes. One of the diagrams can be written in a nice way, and I don't know if I'm drawing the right one, and I may need to flip my indices around to get it right. But one of the diagrams you can sort of think of as having, if I draw, arrows are always a pain, but let's draw them the following way. I think of arrows as corresponding to my chirality associated with the fermions. One of the diagrams actually corresponds to a chirality of type, well, if you like, left coming in and right going out, like this. Okay. One of the, and it, this is what, this is actually the diagram that can lead to then a particular combination of the deltas, which is among the most constrained. And there's two sets of them. The one that is actually goes as delta left left, delta right right, okay, times then a bunch of factors. This is delta mk. Okay.
And the one that doesn't happen is so
this is the one that does not happen in the standard model. Yes. That's right. So there's exactly. So there's this set of operators C1, 2, 3, 4, 5. C4, 5 is the combinations that involve left, left, right, right. And then 2 and 3 is the left, right combination, which I'm going to write in a second. And then, yeah, C1 is the left squared and right squared. Yeah. So this combination, if I write it in the following way, so in terms of imagining that I have a gluino that is, you know, modestly heavier than squarks, just to give you a feeling for the size of this diagram, this will go as roughly this squared to delta mk, delta left ref, delta right right, times other factors, and I'm going to take m tilde, the squark mass, the average squark mass, if you like, to be 500 GeV. Why? Because this is a wonderful number that allows me to compare the various sizes of these contributions. Then delta MK is proportional to this, I should say, proportional to this. But this quantity itself is then restricted to be less than approximately, and it really is approximately 1 × 10⁻⁶ in this combination. Or equivalently, that the deltas themselves, 10⁻³, if we take the gluino mass to be equal to the squark mass. All right, so 10⁻³, what does that mean? It means that I go over to, you know, these mass matrices and I stare at them for a bit and I realize, well, I've got to have 1s here and 10⁻³s in the off diagonal, and this looks very curious. The left-right also comes in. Right? And this is, what's the number? It's about 7.
Okay. So the number on your right depends on what's the squark mass you get,
right? It does indeed. And so what I've done is I'm characterizing the size of this, that this can be for this squark mass, and then you can vary this around. But I'm going to take a particular limit that will be useful to me, which is one where the gluino mass is heavier than the squark mass. Okay, so that I can see then the scaling of this as I change that ratio. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is one.
I don't think you have a squark mass in it squared in the numerator yet.
don't think I have it squared in the numerator yet.
I think right now you have hadronic elements in the numerator and an engluino in the denominator squared, assuming that the gluino mass is heavier than the square.
Okay. So I'm doing this because I'm going to. Okay.
I kind of know what you're going to do, but.
You're in tilde, and this is just a constant, reference constant.
It is.
Not the square.
But is it the Swart mass, or is it, what is it?
No, it's just a reference constant.
If you like, it's a reference constant that I've taken here, so that as I raise the gluino in comparison to this, I can see how this changes. But if you like,
That's fine. All I'm saying is that this operator goes like 1 over the 2D breaking mass squared.
Right, right.
So this is a dimension 6 operator, so the overall scaling. Is not just in the ratio, but also in the absolute scale of the operator.
Indeed. So.
Right.
Very good. So if you like, fine. If you like, I can write this explicitly as something like 500 GeV. Okay.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. I feel better now.
All right. Very good. Excellent. Okay. There are other issues that can also come up with flavor. This is one from the Squark sector. If you go to the Slepton sector, mu to E gamma, now let me draw this diagram. Here we go, one of those. The photon comes off some line, and well, there are a couple of contributions, but the most dangerous one is one in which I have a mu left coming into E right. Here's my Gagino. There is some mixing between the scalars. And the dangerous contribution here is when this delta left right comes in. And this delta left right L 1 2, if I put all of the indices on it, namely lepton, left right, 1 2, this has to be less than approximately, I think I know the number off the top of my head, but let me just look. There we go, yes. Is 10 to the minus 6. Okay. So the branching ratio, I should say, the branching ratio actually goes as this quantity squared. So if you like, I'm writing this as the square root of this size. Okay. This quantity also then scales as 1 upon the Gagino mass, because really what I've got here is a left-handed fermion, a right-handed fermion, and some chirality flip that is resulting from the Gagino Lamont. And it goes through here. By the way, the equivalent contribution to left-left, 1, 2, is less than approximately I believe the number is 7, 10 to the minus 3, but don't force me into getting this 7 better than what I've got. Very good.
And do you have a similar scaling behavior for the
Yeah, so in this case, these things go like 1 upon m, right? Yeah, go, exactly, yeah. So a reference value, if like, divided by the Gagino mass, coming in. Okay. Again, these bounds taken for for sleptons of 500 GeV. Okay, a reference value to give you a size of the, to give you a sense of the size of the constraint. Now again, why is this hugely discrepant? It's because left-right means what? Left-right means I've taken some arbitrary A term over here, and it has no proportionality to the Yukawa coupling. And so really what's going on is, okay, this is very small because there is a non-proportionality in the A terms that basically forces us to be this way. It's, as written, this is far stronger than you would expect in the MSSM, because if you really had an A term of this size, you would also generate a Yukawa coupling for the lepton that would also be large. Okay. So bear that in mind when you compare the size of these numbers. Okay, that's the background.
Question.
Yes.
What's the experiment that exactly knows he's been?
There is the experiment that did it, or the.
You usually came to lecture on neutrino all the time, so the question is what do you actually do to those, right, the missing energy,
Sorry, so mu decays to electron and neutrinos
right.
all the time.
And but you can always have an extra photon flying around.
You could, yes, but you will also have neutrinos. So there are experiments that look explicitly for this decay. Yeah?
Right, where, this is what I'm trying to figure out exactly how you disentangle the left right from the left contribution.
Oh, I'm sorry. So what I'm saying is that if you had a single contribution from supersymmetry that was from a left-right insertion and nothing else, then this would be the bound. If you had a contribution from a right-right insertion, then this would be the bound. And does that make sense? So I'm not saying that the experiment does not constrain these separately. It's the same bound. Mu to E gamma, yeah, it's the same branching fraction that is constraining both. And it's assuming one, I'm just doing the simplest thing, which is you put one into the, you look at the constraints of these operators independently, if you like. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm not sure this will be important for the future, but can you just specify what your assumption about the diagonal terms of the VA is? Is it 1-1-1 or 0-0 the palace?
As written, before I do any rotation, this is something that is arbitrary. Yeah. Good. Okay. The key element to each of these and other processes like this that gets highly constrained in supersymmetry is the fact that if I sort of isolate a particular piece of each of the diagrams, which I'm going to draw here. And now let me sort of rewrite it over here. This is fermion, spermion, Gino, okay, like this, with chiralities done in the following way, Gino mass or something else put in. This element of each of these diagrams, this one duplicated, this one in one unit of it, at least in the amplitude, this corresponds to a dimension 5 operator, which is fermion, 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 depending on how I want to write it, either this star or not, okay, divided by the Gino mass here. Okay. It is exactly this dimension 5 operator, which is the guy that gets the most constrained by these types of putting into diagrams that lead to this type of bound, and similarly for here, when you had a left-right insertion. Okay. This comes from a Gino mass. This could also come from a Gino mass. So you could have a mu downstairs instead of the Gino mass. Similarly, the same A terms over here that can cause problems and can lead to do I want to say that? One moment. I'll talk about A's in a second. Okay, so you have this type of operator, or equivalently the same thing divided by mu for a Higgsino. Okay, now the observation is that each of these operators, if I were to count the R charge associated with them, they have an interesting behavior. So what's R charge? Well, remember, we go back to our superpotential. And here it is in, okay, now there we go. We go back to our superpotential and we imagine the following situation. Let me take the superfields, Q's and U's and D's, to have R charge 1 and the Higgs to be 0. This is an assignment that's at least consistent with what I've written. I'll come to that in a second. So this is the R charge. Associated with these superfields, right? What's the R again? The R is nothing but the chiral rotation that I can do under theta. So since I have a measure here which carries R charge minus 2, this must be balanced out against the rest of the superfields. these assignments, as written there, if I go over and I look at this contribution that entered the flavor-violating observables, this has an R-charge of what? Well, each fermion comes from a superfield whose original R-charge was 1, so it decreases by 1 to go down to the fermion. So this is 0, 0, and then whatever I have for the scalar, which is then plus or minus 2. Which is to say that this operator violates, changes R by 2 units. The same is true of one in which I have a 1 upon mu, where again I'm imagining that in the superpotential we have this as well as a term mu h up, h down, and we can see that this violates the R charge by 2 units as well. An even different way of saying the same thing is, well, let's look at what did I do to end up with this dimension 5 operator. I smushed this out, but really secretly this was taking a Gugino mass insertion in here. The Gugino mass itself is something that came from what? Well, the Gugino, a Gugino mass, a Majorana Gugino mass, m lambda lambda. Yeah. This each has R charge 1, so this shifts R by 2. This is, of course, exactly what we have here in the low energy effective theory.
I don't understand the rough understanding why the left drive is so much more constraining KK by mixing, but do you have sort of an intuitive explanation why the left drive is so much more constrained?
Here. Yes, because this left right came from an A term here, which was not which is not proportional to Yukawa matrix. So this left right, or sorry, this left left here has, if you like, a muon mass divided by V, if you like, a chirality flip there. Okay? And that chirality flip is nothing but
there's some natural suppression already by masses in one of them.
From this here. And you can see this is roughly 4 orders of magnitude, the muon mass over V. Okay, so this operator violates the R symmetry, which has its ultimate origin as this, namely a Gugino mass, which violates the R symmetry by 2 units, and similarly mu, as I've defined the R charges for the Higgses. Okay. So the question is, surely we could do much better with flavor if we were to impose an R symmetry that forbid these operators completely. So that's really the subject of our paper, and the consequences of that are what I'm going to talk about for the remainder. Okay, so what happens when you do this? Well, if you forbid a Majorana mass for the Gugino, the obvious question is, well, where does the mass for the Gugino come from? Well, this is something that goes back a long way. It goes actually all the way back to Joe and Lenny, who wrote this in a paper in 81, I believe, if I remember the date right, and has come back and has come in and out of the field over many years. But it is the idea that instead of giving a mass for the Gugino, which is Majorana here, you give instead a Dirac mass. So to impose an R symmetry on, let me just call it low energy Susie, which is not the MSSM anymore, because it's certainly not M, then we have a Dirac mass for Gugino's. How does this work? Well, you can see that if I were to add a partner to the Gugino, some fermion in the adjoint representation, and give it an appropriate R charge, I can certainly make M Dirac lambda phi R invariant in Lagrangian. This has its origin in the Susie breaking language, if you like, from this operator, where W is the chiral superfield strength associated with whichever gauge I'm interested in. Phi is some superfield which contains this fermion psi. I'll get my Greek letters straight yet. Okay, so this contains the fermion. To make this R invariant, you can see that, well, if I consider this as just a spurion that gets a D term, okay, so W alpha prime I write as theta D, then this will lead to exactly this Dirac mass, as well as other terms in the Lagrangian. But in particular, you can see that then to make this R invariant, these guys, I know exactly what their R charges are. This guy has to be zero, so its fermion is minus one, and so then this all works out. So a Dirac mass for the Gauginos then just allows you to give the Gauginos mass in an R symmetric manner. Well, that's step one. Step two is that the mu term also contributed to R symmetry violation, and you would like to have a solution to that. But that one, in some sense, is even easier. You just imagine having, instead of mu h up, h down, which violates the R symmetry, you replace this with a, let's call it mu up, this set of terms in the superpotential, where R's carry electroweak quantum numbers that are just like Hayes's, so doublets under SU2, plus minus one hypercharge, so that this is each of these combinations is gauge invariant. But to satisfy the R symmetry, these contain R charge 2. Now, once you add new fields that have Higgs-like properties, you might worry, well, what can I write Yukawa couplings with these guys? Again, no, because they contain R charge 2, and if I try to write gauge invariants that satisfy the R symmetry, I can't do it. So this also means that there is no reason to have R's acquire expectation values, and so this R symmetry is not broken by electroweak symmetry breaking. It does not have to be, it's not forced to be this way because of some large coupling to, say, top quarks, which does happen for HU. Okay, so you now have mu terms. So we, just as an accounting here, what have we had to have done? We had to add in a chiral superfield in the adjoint representation for each group, so a color octet, a weak triplet, and some singlet. I had to add in fields in the in Higgs-like representations here, a pair of doublets, okay, with R charge 2. And great, and that's it. This allows me to satisfy, this allows me to write down an R symmetric theory. Now, what are the consequences? Well, one of the most important consequences, and as you saw from sort of, you know, where am I? This contribution here, as well as this contribution to the branching ratio of mu to e gamma here, as well as things like electric dipole moments of particles, which is not flavor violating, but leads to constraints on the CP phases of the various parameters of supersymmetry. These contributions all depend crucially on there being a left-right, an operator that can shift from left to right squarks, which is nothing but the A terms. Yeah, go ahead.
What are the objections or biases against the R symmetry scenario for and generating gluino masses, et cetera, that people have in the community? I'm just curious, because there are, I know that some people think, it's not quite natural, there's problems. What are the standard objections people raise?
You're asking me, why do I not like my model?
No, I'm asking you why they're wrong. I know that there's a bias up there, and I'm trying to remember. I don't remember what it is.
Maybe the simplest thing is let me proceed in a few steps, and then we can. Things will come up, I think.
Beautiful. I'm worried about the.
I'd like to cover the.
Let me finish the beautiful part.
Yeah, let me finish the beautiful part, and then let me go. But let me say. I mean, the simplest statement is. As a low-energy effective theory, that you just have Dirac masses. This is completely fine. There's nothing wrong with this. The only issues that you concern yourself with at all are issues, if you like, of the UV. And there's a number of questions there, and we can get to them near the end, shall we say. I don't want to delve into that now if I don't have to. Okay?
Wait, I just want to ask one question without being perfectly fine. What's the Higgs mass work out to be in this? Is there a constraint on this from the Higgs mass?
Our wonderful scalar, the Higgs mass. All right, good. So what Steve is asking about is, if we have these operators that generate for me a Dirac mass, then you can show, as you proceed through this to write out the D terms for this theory, that actually the contributions to the Higgs mass vanish. The tree level contributions to the Higgs mass will vanish, okay, because the D term also will vanish. The electroweak D terms. Okay. So then you can say, well, what do you do about that? Well, there's two obvious things. One is simply you go to an NMSSM, of which you have additional particle, and you can add in a contribution to the tree level quartic. And that's the simplest thing to do. There are other things you can do, which I'm happy to talk about later. But
sorry, what's the architecture of the system?
Because the electroweak D terms vanish in a theory that has only Dirac masses, that has only if you like D terms supersymmetry breaking. This goes to the super soft story, which is and since Neil is in the audience,
it's not obvious. One way to do this is if you only write down that operator, right? Integral d2 theta w prime w alpha phi, then you put in theta for the d term, the actual SU2 d term, for instance, and then you pull out the actual off shell operator is m sub d scalar from the adjoint d, right? So if that's the only place that the scalar actually appears in your theory, then when you apply its equations of motion and you integrate it out, just take the derivative respect. So just take the respect to A, you get D equal to zero identically. So that's one way to see it. If you want to see it diagrammatically, there's now a trilinear term that when you integrate it out will cancel off the quartics. But if you have, you know, also soft masses for the scalar, then that cancellation is incomplete proportional to the additional soft masses, which there are here, which there weren't before.
Exactly. So this goes to two solutions to it. One, which I told Steve. The second one, which is, since this is a cancellation that is exact at tree level in the limit that the scalar partners here in the adjoint representation, specifically the triplet, in the limit that they are massless. So as you raise their mass, then this so-called cancellation, if you like, that causes the D term to vanish, goes away. And so, okay, so if you take scalars here to be, say, of order the Gugino mass, then you actually generate a tree level quartic, albeit somewhat suppressed by some, you know, some mass function that depends on this ratio. This is a possibility that we imagine can happen in our theory. That was not assumed to happen in Neil's supersoft story. Neil's supersoft story was specifically to imagine that all of the supersymmetry breaking arose from the D terms, from the Dirac Gugino masses. And I'll come into this in more detail in a second. But yeah. Maxine had a question. Fantastic. Rama.
The new particle content. Does that spoil unification, or?
Two answers. So answer to yours first. This is just a. That's true, but this one I can answer faster. This is a U1 if you like.
But when he answered your question before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Actually, this is just a spurion of Suzy breaking. Okay? So if you like, you can treat this as if my hidden sector contained F terms and D terms, of some size that is comparable but not exactly the same. And this is the leading order operator for a Dirac genome mass that I can write. And then I can have F-term spurions as well, except that I imagine that this is R-symmetric. So that if you treat this like an O'Rafferty model. And with that, then I can give scalar mass squareds that are completely flavor arbitrary from F terms, and at the same time generate terms proportional to D.
At any rate, Chava, you don't need anything charging the U1 in the standard model. Like,
yes.
One prime doesn't have to charge anything. So.
Yes, yes, exactly.
There is a new U1, but it's
very much like, it's like saying there is a...
It has to be, because otherwise the D term contribution there would contribute to all the scalar masses in the standard model.
It's, yeah, fine. Unification, that was your question. Yes, so there is a color triplet, color octet, a weak triplet that comes in, as well as these guys. Generically, they don't unify. You can play games to make them to unify, things like unification in trinification as opposed to SU5. And there's a story there, but that's a UV question, which I don't want to get into.
The minimal R-symmetric model doesn't unify. That's impossible.
You can phrase it that way if you like. I could go on my tirade about unification, but let me not waste time on that. Okay, very good. So we have. We have a model at low energies that has these properties. But there is one other vital property that comes along with Dirac masses for gay genomes. And where am I going to erase? Let me erase here. Okay. The second property of a Dirac mass, in addition to it being R-preserving, the contribution of a Dirac mass to scalar masses, so the diagrams that you would ordinarily think about, what am I drawing here? There we go. Okay, so here we have some scalar and a gay genome running in the loop. These sort of diagrams were used to imagining that they generate scalar masses proportional to the gay genome mass, proportional in the following way, so that m tilde squared is proportional to g squared, root factor, j genome mass squared, log of whatever you like, m over the renormalization scale, okay? Something like this. So this is what happens for Majorana masses, as written. For scalar masses that result from this Dirac mass, there is no log. Okay, they are finite with respect to the Dirac mass. And this comes about because the leading order operator that you can write for the scalar mass squared itself that arises from a D term whose origin led to the gay genome mass, the Dirac gay genome mass, this leading order operator is a higher dimensional operator, so there is no counterterm you can write for this. And I can go through that if people want me to, but suffice to say, the scalar mass squared is finite, not log divergent. The consequence of this is that you can naturally take the ratio M, the Dirac, maybe I should even emphasize, Dirac gay genome mass divided by the scalar mass to be of order, the inverse of this, so 4 pi upon G, okay, and life is fine. Okay, we'll see what this means in a second. Okay, so now let me try to assemble all of these ingredients together to tell you how the flavor gets suppressed in our symmetric model. Well, actually, all of the ingredients are basically on the board. Number one is these types of. One loop contribution to the gluino mass. So in the scenario I'm going to imagine, the gay genomes are heavier than the squarks and sleptons. So the you can already see the elements on here that allow us to remove out many of the flavor problems. So number one is all of these dimension 5 operators that you have that violate R are gone due to the absence of the gauge mass and absence of a mu term. This means that that the leading order operators that I can write, the way the piece of the diagram that I was writing here that was dimension 5, it doesn't exist. And then the leading order operator I can write has to be something that takes the form of this. There we go. Tilde over m gauge mass squared in a limit in which the gauge mass is heavier than the scalar. So that the diagram, if you like, is something that looks like that in terms of the chiralities. Okay, this additional power of the gauge mass in these insertions means that at each place here where I had a 1 upon gauge mass squared now goes over into 1 upon gauge mass to the fourth power. So if I take this as some fixed scale, this is 500 GeV. This now goes like the fourth power. This will go like, hang on a moment with this operator. This one goes like the fourth power. I'll come to this in a second. This will go like this quantity squared, okay? Because the relevant operator I insert is this. Okay, that means that if you can take the gauge mass somewhat heavier than, say, the squark mass, the characteristic mass here, then I can further suppress the contributions to delta m sub k because, well, now I only need a modest hierarchy between the gauge mass and the scalar mass to suppress the size of this diagram. How much do I need? Well, you can sort of read it off from here. The only trick is that there are several, so there's a couple of subtleties. One of them is that when you have operators that only involve a Dirac mass, a Dirac gauge mass, the numerical value of this, roughly speaking, goes to about more like 5. Okay? This is simply just look at the set of operators you have and you calculate the constraints, and roughly speaking, this is what you get. Then if you translate this and you turn this into, you know, how big deltas can be for, say, some gauge mass, you can see that, well, if I take the gauge mass to be of order 4 pi times a scalar mass, 500 GeV, I can take the deltas to be of order, what is this, 0.3 or so, okay? And things are, and life is safe. So it is the combination of being able to raise the Dirac mass relative to the scalar mass by about a 4 pi, naturally, without getting, you know, contributions to the scalar masses, as well as the fact that these operators come in now to double the power that you thought before, that you can suppress these contributions. Okay. That's what happens with, say, operators that are like left, left, right, right. What about something like left, right, right, left? Well, this required going to a scalar trilinear coupling, an A. What is this coupling? Well, again, let's write it in terms of an operator. It would correspond to something like Q tilde, say, for the case of hand here, d h down, okay, something like this with an a of some flavor. Okay. Let's now count the R charge associated with this. So, well, the Higgs gets an expectation value, but this we know has R charge 0. The scalars came from superfields, which had R charge 1. So this whole operator actually has R charge 2. Which is to say that if you enforce an R symmetry, you don't have A terms at all. So all of these concerns here are gone. These contributions to K not K not bar mixing are gone. This constraint is gone. Okay. And all of the other things you're used to thinking about that tend to be constrained in supersymmetry. Epsilon prime upon epsilon is highly sensitive to the left-right. Okay, now, to leading order, it's gone. There's no constraint. Contributions to EDMs of the electron-neutron quarks go proportional to, typically, to left-right insertions. So they are also gone. So you solve a great number of the flavor and related problems by enforcing an R-symmetry which kills the A-terms and forces the leading order interactions with Gaugino's heavy to be dimension 6 instead of dimension 5. Okay.
But does this mean LHC is going to see those Gaugino's? Do you have Gaugino's?
Good. Well, that's the second part of my talk. The leading statement to that is that, for example, to keep K0 bar small enough, to keep the contribution from supersymmetry small enough, while having order 0.3 or so or thereabouts mixings in the squark sector, I would need a Dirac Gaugino mass of, as you can see, 4 pi above scalars. For the scalars I chose here, that would be 5 TeV. So you're talking the several TeV range is where you would generically expect this to be if these things are indeed large. Now, there are a number of other things. Let me just look for a second here.
Is the R-symmetry anomalous or not?
No. In the MSSM, it is not anomalous. Yeah. Okay. The one piece of this puzzle, because I have presented and sort of schematically shown the nature of how you kill off many of these contributions with an R-symmetric model, but there's always even some degree of pain, and I'm not even talking about UV pain. I'm talking about low energy things to worry about. In the strongest constraint of all, which I'm surprised hasn't even been brought up by someone yet, so I will bring it up myself, is that, well, delta n sub k is indeed constrained in supersymmetry to be roughly 10 to the minus 6 here, okay, and it's 10 to the minus 5 in the R-symmetric model. If you look at the imaginary part of this, which is nothing but epsilon sub k when I take an appropriate ratio, this is going to be proportional to the same combination here, okay? But it is now constrained to be smaller by another roughly 2 orders of magnitude, so neighborhood of 10 to the minus 7. And by this, what this means then is that either the deltas have to be the deltas associated with the mixings that enter into just this wonderful K0 bar are even smaller than we think, or the phase is 10 to the minus 2-ish, or some combination thereof. This is, in the end, the epsilon sub k is by far the most constraining of supersymmetry in general, but also of this model. And as far as we can tell, if you like, this is it. In other words, you can go down the list of all of the different observables that are there, mu, de, gamma, et cetera, and go down through the full list. And as long as you're willing to take, this hierarchy to be of order 4 pi, everything can be safe with, say, order 0.3 coefficients in the deltas, except for epsilon sub k, again, unless this phase is 10 to the minus 2 or so. Okay? And that's it. That's the one price to have to pay. Now, obviously, this price is a far better one in this model than over a generic MSSM, but it is still there.
Given that 9.5 delta could be relatively big, could that have observable effects in favor of physics like radiation or something?
Ooh, that's getting to my next page. Fantastic. Yes. So, right. And this. Of course, I'm worried about it, I'm worried about it.
I'm not worried about it.
It depends on who you ask in the collaboration as to whether they're worried about it. No,
you have to tune several phases.
Well, you could just have your soft masses be real. I mean, that's not a big deal.
There is.
I need to know about CP violation, right?
But that's a CP problem. That's a problem.
There is.
That's not spatial to him, and that problem is, as he said, already it's a problem to him.
There is one qualitative difference, which I like to hang my hat on, which is that the contributions to epsilon sub k come from contributions such as this, left, left, right, right, and, or the imaginary part of this. They also come from other things like left, right operators and contributions that would depend on things like the phases in A, or phase of mu, or some invariant combination. Okay, those don't exist here. So at least to the extent that phases enter into epsilon sub k, there are invariants that enter. I'm not saying there aren't, but the number of possibilities that you can have to enter into for phases to enter into epsilon sub k is smaller in an R symmetric model. Does that help? Well, it, all right. Now you want me to count phases? I don't want to count them, but the statement is the number of invariants is actually much smaller. So that might lead to then a new avenue for how you could try to suppress this in some other model, some variation. Good.
I mean, can I just throw in, since we're talking about this, I mean, you can imagine scenarios like, suppose your squark masses are like, suppose at leading order you have like, you sort of go through and you sprinkle 100, 200 GeV soft masses, even with arbitrary phases throughout your theory. You will get a radiative correction to your squark masses, which is of order, you know, a few hundred GeV if you have these, you know, the few TeV bluinos. Yeah. So if you do that, then maybe that's not as much fun phenomenologically, but at least it's a plausible story where basically all the flavor physics, all the soft masses really are random and have phases and everything like that. But when you actually calculate this, then the deltas won't be, you know, the deltas then will be smaller. So, and you wouldn't say that's a theory with a flavor symmetry. That would be a fully flavor violating theory, but you know, it'd still be fine for epsilon sub k. Now you're close enough. You're only two orders of magnitude off with epsilon sub k with very large deltas. So if there is any reason which causes your deltas to be somewhat small, since it's squared, you know, epsilon sub k can be okay. There's lots of stories for epsilon sub k. That's not why I'm worried about it.
Sorry.
What could be also part rates?
The statement, I don't know how many picked up on that quickly, so let me just restate it in just a simple way, quickly. So the statement is, and which I didn't make, which is these scalar masses from the loop contributions, these finite scalar masses, are flavor diagonal. And so to the extent that you could imagine, you could have asked the question, can I just keep on raising the gauge Eno mass? How far up do I need to go so that this thing is suppressed? Surely, well, if I've got two orders of magnitude, what do I need to do? Okay, it's not as bad as you think, because as you keep on raising the gauge Eno mass, you actually end up generating flavor-blind contributions to the squarks, and so that naturally causes these things to become small. This is Neil's point. Raman.
Sort of connected to the question I was going to ask, which was the scalar masses, of course, could have had some, you know, UV contribution, which makes them comparable to the gauge Eno masses. The fact that they are an order of magnitude lighter than the gauge Eno masses, it's not the result of some RG.
Correct. It is.
Guaranteeing me that or anything like that. That's something you can put into the UV, some form of, dare I say, it's a quest frame or, you know, some suppression.
Yes.
This is like gauge Eno mediation of a sort.
Of a sort, exactly. But unlike gauge Eno mediation, you don't generate these log-enhanced contributions.
Right.
Exactly.
Some kind of Iraqi gauge Eno mediation.
Yeah. If you're interested in the UV question of how do I arrange for a 4 pi higher.
The problem is tangled with a UV question. So the question is how much of that problem do you want to.
It's in part, but remember here, we've become far less sensitive to the UV nature of the problem. Usually one of the problems is, well, do I break flavor above or below the Suzy breaking scale? I've become dramatically insensitive to that issue here now. So
you do get about a factor of 3 from the run. You know, in pushing the gluinos up, you get about a factor of 3. And that doesn't take you all the way, but okay. So now I want another factor of 3. I want you to give me another factor of 3 at the tree level.
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to figure out what the value add of the Dirac nature of the story is on top of gauge Eno mediation. Right? So
gauge Eno mediation, you have to understand why there's 0
I see. Here you're just saying.
Here you have to understand why they're a factor of, you know, why instead of having you, why you have, you know, TeV gluminos and you have a few hundred GeV squarks.
I see. Okay.
That's a totally different story.
Yeah, yeah. In some sense, and in my mind, and for this workshop, the most interesting aspect of the model is the fact that you can end up having deltas, particularly, for example, in the lepton sector, can be really truly order one, and in the quark sector, all but perhaps, you know, some combinations of the 1, 2, down 5 entries can also be order one in size. This large flavor violation means that when you produce a squark, you have no idea. It is not a top squark. It is not a strange squark or whatever it is. It is some arbitrary mixture of that. And so that leads to the potential of qualitatively different phenomenology at the LHC. And let me, in sort of, I know I'm almost out of, well, I'm essentially out of time, but I, in the last,
spirit of the workshop,
in the spirit of the workshop, I am going to just say a couple, let me just say a couple of words about the kind of things you could look for. And I should emphasize that this is work that's ongoing with a number of people, including Tuan Roy at Oregon and Adam Martin, and as well as my student and others looking at some of the phenomenology. Okay, so one aspect of the phenomenology that is interesting, at least from the squark side, is now if you imagine producing squarks, here's what you would have ordinarily done, and you still do. But now instead of these squarks being of one particular flavor in their decay, oh, I just remembered, Xu Feng is in the audience. Oh, fantastic. You can ask the question again if you want. Well, thank you. I guess you're hungry. Okay. If you produce squarks and they decay to some LSP, yeah, through this decay, there is the flavor is arbitrary. So you could imagine that one of them will go to a top, one will go to some fermion, some which could be say the U or C, for example. So that in a collider, this will be observed as a single top, large missing energy, and jet, yeah, which has a signal that is much more similar to say single top production than anything else. So it is interesting then to consider, is this a handle that you can get at trying to observe flavor violation, but now at the LHC, and in this context, in the squark sector. You can do...
If they want to ask a question, can I ask a question?
I don't think I've asked the same question again.
Very good.
So if you assume LHC is missing energy, but...
Yes.
Is it kind of gaugino, or it's just neutrino?
The way I've written it, I'm imagining it's a gaugino. The kind of gaugino I could imagine, so the gaugino I could imagine, so I can easily imagine this to be, as written the way I've done the model thus far, to be a Higgsino, neutral Higgsino. Yeah. And in terms of the mass hierarchy, this is completely fine. Yeah, exactly. Well, there's new terms, and yeah, that's right, exactly. And then if you want me to go further into that, I'll make more comments. But it could also be, for example, a combination of Higgsino and Singlino. And if you play this game, you can end up getting potentially a relic abundance that will work out very nicely, as Neil and I are just discovering at this workshop, by the way.
So you're mentioning that our symmetry is exact.
I'm one at a time, sorry. Go ahead, Jack.
You mean one of these R's?
One of these R's. In the limit of an exact R symmetry, it's a mix, right? It's a Dirac mass between an R and a Higgs. So yeah. Saying it's an R is.
Meant by Singlino?
Oh no, I'm sorry. By Singlino, I actually mean an additional singlet in the model. Actually, a pair of singlets that have differing R charges, and with that you can assist in raising the Higgs mass of the model because of this issue of the D terms. It's an NMSSM, but for this model. Yeah, a Dirac NMSSM, if you like. Okay. Yeah.
But if you erase that, then the R's, then the dark matter would become
principal mixture. Yeah, R mu, yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
No, R's are not stable. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's just a Dirac mass between a fermion from an R superfield and a fermion from the Higgs. Yeah. Steve. Fantastic. Okay, so clearly we're all getting hungry. Just as you can have squark production and this flavor biology, you can imagine something analogous. I mean, both almost a diagram that looks literally identical to this, except now it's Z gamma. You go into sleptons, and in this process, again, you can imagine flavor, completely flavor arbitrary states here and leading to, say, emu missing energy type of signals. This is the kind of thing you can look for. By the way, you will also want to, you also check and go and look for things like same sign leptons. This is the famous signature of supersymmetry with Majorana masses. We have no Majorana masses to leading order. We have no same sign signal at all. Of course, the absence of signals is rarely a wonderful prediction for a collider, but in any case, it's a cross-check to get at this. And there are other ways. You can get sleptons coming out through neutralino decay and getting a lepton and getting flavor violation from this mechanism. So these are some interesting questions, among others, that a number of us are now studying, and actually that some progress I hope to make while I'm here at the workshop. Okay, thank you.
Except, can you make your fermion masses be exactly zero and get all their masses from this, or does that not work?
Can I make these exactly zero? Yeah. I don't want to make them exactly zero.
We're talking about tree level, though.
I'm saying they can get. They're going to get some mass from this loop diagram. Can that be the only source of their mass?
If that's true, we end up into Neil's scenario of super soft supersymmetry breaking. And if that's true, then the masses are flavor diagonal. And so the story with respect to flavor is,
you don't need any of the rest.
Okay. And conversely, if I do want to let them have some anarchic but small masses, does this story still work with the flavor suppression? Does it still work if I give the Gaginos a comparable Majorana mass? So I break the R symmetry a little bit, but have it be suppressed?
Right, you're asking the question then, how big could a Majorana Gagino mass be adding into this model? Right. What does it do?
Because I might say it might look unnatural to give those scalars some small masses, but not have any masses for the Gaginos, because I don't know any mechanisms that do that.
So a simple example of that is if I simply have a dummy prime that gets a D term, and which, so necessarily this thing is R charge 1, and then I have a hidden sector field that has R charge 2 that gets an F term. Then with these two spurions, I can give scalar masses from the usual X factor X, Q factor 2, and the Geller potential, IJ, arbitrary in flavor. But I can't write an invariant in terms. I can't write an XWW because this violates the Marsden.
And so if your Suzy breaking has preserved an R symmetry, then you can't write Majorana.
All right. So that's the statement with this. Then you can ask the separate question of, well, suppose there is just some source of R symmetry violation, some other spurion, whatever you have, and then how big can it be? Well, obviously, the dangerous thing that's going to happen is the places where I had previously left-right insertions, this turns out to be the most dangerous one, then I need to suppress the Gaginos mass to be small to get this to go. And now, if you force me to now think about exactly the size, I have to tell you offline. But the Gaginos mass has to be, I don't remember the suppression off the top of my head. I know that in KK bar mixing that it is the left right which is the most dangerous, and it was roughly that if the size of the Gaginos mass is from anomaly deviation from this scale, from the scale of the scalars, then this is roughly in, this is this, the flavor story roughly goes through, as I say. The bounds in Cana Bar are a little bit worse than what I portrayed here. But that's roughly the same.
So what's the advantage of the small over the super soft model? I mean, so you just told us there's a simple limit and that you don't need any of this stuff. So there surely has to be some reason why you want to.
This goes to then a matter of whether you can, can you leave the room first?
I can back up my own model.
Okay, so the leading order concern you have with Neil's model is generating Hayes mass, right? Because you have this issue of canceling off the term entirely. You have to go to an MSSM and then proceed from there.
But you may be doing it anyway.
We may be doing it anyway for our own purposes. That's right. But
the scows in that model end up very light. You know, for a similar reason to gauge mediation, so you end up with a very, very spread apart spectrum there also. Then there's this, why don't you have any F-terms in your theory? You naturally expect some sort of.
And for us, all we really need, for the star to go through, we needed this, you know, 4 pi hierarchy, so, you know, similar. So this is one way to.
But then, isn't needed
in the super soft, is that correct? That's correct. Well, not only is it not needed, this still not exists in super soft. Right? Super soft, and by sort of by definition, is everything from the terms. From an LHC perspective, we're not interested necessarily in the model of the universe. Otherwise, why wouldn't I do a gauge mediation all over again? We're interested in thinking about, in my opinion, what kind of low-energy models can we have such that, and then what are the signals that come out? And up until thinking about this type of model and some flavor variance that appeared before this, you would never have expected slept-on flavor violation to be order one.
And you can ask sort of a similar question when you talk about gauge mediation versus, you know, anything with additional soft masses. Like, if I say, here's some theory with soft masses and everything like that, and you say, well, why don't you just do gauge mediation? And you say, well, because I don't think that that's necessarily the most generic theory of this class. You know, I think the most generic theory of this class has these features in it.
Okay. Any other questions?
A brief verse, so Neil is going to lead a discussion.